So, good morning, everybody. Today's our topic of discussion is on compassion and world peace. I'm not sure how much I'm going to, how much I'll be able to present. So I'll try my best. Every sentient being desires for happiness, peace, and do not want any kind of suffering. We humans, like other sentient beings, put our every effort for cultivating more peace, happiness, tranquility, because we are short of these qualities. We are running short of these things which we really cherish from the depth of our heart. We have every right to be happy, have a quality of life, satisfaction life. But through our own experience, we get to see that we are not meeting with these things. We are often run with so many difficulties, physical, mental, and emotional difficulties. And in our endeavor to bringing and experiencing these qualities, we have gear our energy, physical strength, mental strength, emotional strength towards the progress of the material wealth, thinking that the material wealth is the ultimate source of our lasting peace and happiness. While doing so, we have neglected basic human qualities such as genuine sense of loving and care for each other, human to human respect, appreciation to others, religion and culture. Appreciation of the fact that we live in a world where we are now totally and utterly dependent on each other for our very survival on this earth. As a result of this, we get to see more problems, in the family, in the community, and more problems and violence in the world at large. more and more gap between rich and poor, between richer nations and poor nations. During my visit to the United States in 1983, when I was, as I mentioned yesterday briefly, visiting many Catholic Benedictine and Trappist monasteries, our trip ended, started from New York and ended in New York. And after the trip, we were supposed to go to meet the Pope John Paul II, and arrangements were being made to have an audience with John Pope Paul II. So while the arrangement was being made, we were kind of stuck in New York City. And when we first landed in New York, right from the airport, we were taken to, I think, one of the 5-star hotels. So we stayed in that hotel, and we didn't get to see anything else than the hotel and the surrounding areas. So during our whole trip, we got to see the nursing homes, assisted living areas, hospitals, of course schools that are being run by the Catholic Benedictine monasteries, and the colleges that were also being run by them. But we didn't get to see really, really outside. So when we were stuck in New York City, our trip ended. So that means the host was not going to pay anymore. So we landed in staying in a Tibetan people's home, and their apartment was in one of the, I think, poorest places in New York City. That's called Henry Street, and the Canal Street and Henry Street somewhere, you know, just Chinatown, you know, where that. So we got stuck there, and the apartment was so poor. The windows were, you know, there was no shutters to close the windows, you know. So one time some thief came and they stole the TV and other things, you know, that belonged to our host people. So in this way, and one time we heard a really huge noise, and then when looked down and what was happening, the gang parties were, you know, firing and shooting at each other, and then police came, and well, they took away those gangs, you know, arrested and those gangs like that. So then we happened to visit, of course, the subways, right? Because we wanted to travel, subways down, back and forth, and in those stations, we were able to see so many homeless. So many homeless, you know. So I asked my host, why are there so many homeless? The United States regarded as, in India, we would never imagine like that, you know, because we take United States something like a paradise, you know, that everyone had, so everyone had everything like that. But when we got to see these poor homeless, really, it didn't get in my mind, so sad to see them. But he said, it is nothing, these are the These are the some kind of, you know, some people, there's nothing there. You can get to see more people like this, you know. And I said, where can I see those more people? And he said, we'll take you there. So one day he took me to the bridge, under the bridge, you know. That bridge runs from New York to maybe to New Jersey, like that, right? Under that bridge, there's so many homeless in, you know, carports, right, like that. So, you see, in the midst of these high-rise buildings, in the midst of these wealthy people, in the midst of all these great things, there's thousands of, you know, homeless people who really live in such a difficult, you know, such a poor situation. And this is the United States. You cannot imagine like this. And then during my stay in Portland, someone told me that there's about 4,000 homeless children, 4,000 homeless children in Portland itself, around Oregon itself, like that. And then I get to visit a place called Dignity Village. That's an association of homeless people in Portland. And the Dignity Village is right near to a wonderful prison. That prison has every facility, right? It's whereas these Dignity Village are having, you know, problem of shortage of running water. So what is going on in our mind, you know, in our leader's mind, in our, you know, so-called social, you know, worker's mind, in our educationists, in our college, you know, professors, all of these people, responsible people are, you know, responsible people's mind, right? So, in this way, really, this is just about here, you know, maybe just a, maybe you always say, just a tip of iceberg, you know, as you usually say, we have this kind of, you know, expression. But then, when we look in the other parts of the world, in India, this never come in my mind. I cannot accept, but there's no way to. There's WHO, you know, World Health Organization, which has like 5-story, and parked in front of them, you know, Mercedes, all those UN cars and like that, right? Right behind them, there's slum, thousands of, you know, people living in such a pitiable condition. I sometimes wonder why these WHO people are not seeing the people right in front of them, you know. So what are they doing? You sometimes really wonder, you know. So this is really the situation of the world. You know, this is the situation of the world. So if we look at really how these situations have arisen, this, you know, big gap between rich and poor, so much violence. You know, right now, as you everybody knows, that there's so much now violence going on in the Middle East. The Indians use the word, you know, West Asia, and I think the Americans use the word Middle East. I don't know why they're using these two different terms for the same place, you know. West Asia. Indians always use this word, you know, West Asia. And then you tend to use Middle East, right? Which is which, whatever. But there is problem, you know, always there is problem. There's, from how many years it has been, you know, there has been problem. There has been problem. And it is not, you know, getting better in any way. In any way. So, why all this has happened is, from the Buddhist perspective, we have neglected something while giving so much importance to something else. We have given so much importance to, you know, the material wealth. So much, so much, thinking that material wealth is something like a god that can bestow you, you know, everything while you need it. Of course, you know, we do need material progress. We do need, you know, good housing accommodations. We do need good running water. We do need electricity. But beyond that, we have gone beyond the limit of, you know, acquiring the material wealth. And while doing so, it seems that we have really forgotten the basic human nature, which is, you know, love and caring for each other, appreciation for each other's contribution. Basic human touch, sense of, you know, respect for each other within the family, within the community, within the world at large. This is being really, when we are born into this world, whenever you see a child being born, you know, he's born crying. Why? He's asking for something. Crying, he could not speak at that time, so the best possible for him to make, you know, aware the mother, the best possible means that to make his or her, you know, mom aware of that he's needing something is to cry. And then why he's crying is he's asking for love. He's asking for love. He's asking for care. When a mother touches the baby child, and when the mother hugs her, the baby child, right away we get to see that he starts crying. And of course, when the baby is fed with milk, he starts crying. It's because from the most innate being, we need love and care, sense of, you know, compassionate attitude from other people. And this has been, you know, this value has been now being seen to be neglected. So because of this, now we have started to tend to become more greedy, more grasping, more wanting. It's like a big monster opening his mouth and wanting to have everything, you know, like that. It's like that. But this is not the proper solution to our human bringing human peace and tranquility. You must look inward and find out that what is now needed to cultivate, what is needed to find out and see what we need to do some kind of transformation. It is only by seeing that others are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. It is only by seeing that, like myself, others also need a quality life. It is only through seeing that others need a successful life like myself. And if we are able to think in this way, then from the Buddhist perspective, it is said that how we are going to relate with at such situation. At such situation, now we will be able to consider that others are more in terms of majority, in terms of number, compared to myself. So instead of, you know, sacrificing the majority of people for my just single person's well-being, it is much, much, much more appreciative to sacrifice oneself for others' well-being. If you are not able to sacrifice in the beginning, of course it is very difficult, but not take the advantage of others for my own well-being. So here comes the practice of what is called, as you know, equalizing self for others and then exchanging oneself for others. Shantideva, in his Guide to Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Mangdu Shiva Chishuku Shiva Rangi Tenjeta Pulashingi Tenjebe Dinitini Kabar Tenis. When we look at the benefit of thought for cherishing others, benefit of being open-mindedness, benefit of being compassionate to others, and the harmfulness or the dangers of self-centered attitude, we do not need to go in detail. It will be sufficient just by looking at the Buddha's life, Shakyamuni Buddha's life. Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, devoted his whole life for the benefit of other sentient beings. Because of that, even by just hearing his name, we get some kind of, you know, solace. Even just by seeing his image, we get some kind of solace, soothing in our mind, some kind of peace in our mind. When we enter into this hall, when we look at the Buddha statue, there will be not a moment that you are kind of in a disturbed state. Right away, you feel peace and tranquility. Right away, there is some kind of, you know, sense of kind of that, oh, this is a wonderful person. Wonderful person. I must be like him. When you look at his face, he is so simple. He's not wearing any kind of, you know, brocades. Look at him. He's not wearing any kind of, you know, hat. Just looking at his face, there is some kind of solace we get. Why? It's because he is the embodiment of love and compassion. And he devotes his life for the well-being of all the sentient beings. When we hear the name of Mahatma Gandhi, everybody who knows about Mahatma Gandhi see him as an embodiment of non-violence. Everybody says he's a wonderful man. Likewise with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Just by being in his presence, it's like you are being kind of somewhere, you are being kind of immersed in his energy of compassion. All the afflictive emotions, all the destructive emotions are right away subsided. you feel that you are living in some kind of, you know, pure land with Him. Why? It's because He is radiating the message of peace and compassion. And while radiating the message of peace and compassion, He Himself being the embodiment of peace and compassion. That is why there's wherever He goes, wherever He happens to be, thousands are, you know, thousands of follow Him. People follow Him, appreciate Him, respect Him, wanting to be near to Him, even for just for one moment. He's being appreciated and respected by all the followers of all the major religions of the world, because He always mentions that the basic message of all the religions of the world is same and one. That is peace and love and peace for the humanity. Some years back, there was a trouble in Ladakh. There was a conflict between the Muslim community and the Buddhist community. And that conflict really went very far, to the point that both communities started boycotting, buying each other's goods. So the Muslims were not supposed to buy, you know, anything that is sold by the Buddhists, and the Buddhists were not supposed to buy anything that is sold by, you know, Muslims. Not only that, Buddhists were not supposed to take the buses or the taxis, the cars that were run by and owned by the Muslims. And the Muslims reciprocated in the same way. There was total chaos in that small town where there is scarcity of everything. Scarcity of vegetables, scarcity of foods, scarcity of the basic needs. If you were going to do like this, by calling, where are you going to meet? How are you going to survive? Both communities suffered so much. But they went on doing like this, you know, in a very stubborn way. And no one was being able to come and, you know, intervene this difficult situation, solve this problem. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama got a message saying this must be stopped, that both communities must live peacefully together. And when this message was reached to Ladakh, the first community to respect His message was Muslim community, ironically. And what they did was they pasted His message on the walls everywhere. And in this way, you know, the problem was solved. So there is really need for some kind of, you know, from each and every individual, some kind of sense of sharing for others. Some kind of, you know, seeing that we live in this world very, very dependently to each other. When you look back in the history, during, say, like the old civilizations, Mesopotamian civilization, you know, Babylonian civilization, like the Chinese civilization, and then Indus Valley civilization, when we look at their civilizations, most of the time, it seemed that they lived a beautiful life. Even though whenever there was some kind of fighting, it was a fighting between maybe one or two tribes. And that fighting didn't make, you know, big impact on that whole civilization. Now we have reached to a situation when a kind of a fighting goes here in the East, that can affect the fight, that can affect the West. We have already seen the impact of the violence that is going on in the Middle East. The oil prices has also started rising. And if something happens to Asia, I think the West will definitely suffer, because much of the products now, especially the products in the United States, are made in China. Made in Taiwan. Now many of the products that are being made in India may be coming to here. And then we have now situation what is called as outsourcing. India is becoming, you know, one of the fastest nations where all these call centers are being set up. It is taught now. Interdependent, it is the interdependent nature. We need to understand. So if this is the case, then we must look for long-term mutual benefit rather than short-term my benefit. If we look for short-term for my benefit, in the end, this will hurt myself as well as the large world at large. On the other hand, if we look long term mutual benefit, then the world will be much more, you know, beautiful, happier than what is now happening here. Buddha's teaching on interdependence, interdependent nature. I wonder sometimes how he got this wonderful idea. Nobody on this earth, the spiritual figures, spoken so eloquently, so beautifully, that too in relation with our life, that too in relation with our world, that too in relation with our environment. He spoke about this 2,550 years ago. Now it is becoming more and more relevant, his teachings, especially the theory of interdependent origination, how we are so much connected to to each other. To the point that maybe whatever we are eating today has some kind of, you know, interconnection of the other parts of the world. Whatever we get on the table. For example, this morning we had watermelon. And then in the spoken area, watermelon doesn't grow here, right? Mm-hmm. So we have this fortunate to have watermelon. Where it did come from? Must have come from South America or Mexico or somewhere else, right? So in this way, our really survival is dependent on someone else's kindness, someone else's compassionate attitude. Of course, we are paying for such things, but if they are not cultivated there, our money will not be able to buy anything like that. His Holiness one time mentioned that in the West there is so much, you know, use of cars. Everywhere there is car. But he said, if the oil runs out, what are you going to do with your car? Are you going to carry it on your back? Or otherwise there's no use for it, right? So much dependence, you know, for other kindness, others' kindness. So here comes again Buddhist teaching of that all the mother sentient beings are kind to us, kind to each of us. So if they have been kind in this way, then it is really morally and ethically wrong from our side to neglect their well-being. So we must need to think about their well-being. And in thinking about their well-being, there are many ways of having them. Of course, improving the education. This I really feel very important, especially, you know, improving the quality of education in other parts of the world. Of course, there is also need for the improving the quality of education in the United States. Many of people are telling about this to me. Because without education, especially in the third world countries, there's so much problem of like caste system. Looking down at women. And whereby women are kind of treated as second class citizens. This is due to lack of education. And because of this lack of education, when child is born, especially a girl child is born, the parents do not want to have them. So there's a problem of, you know, situation of child infanticide. So education as a part of our repaying kindness for the other humanities, I think it would be really wonderful from our side if we could work on educating, giving some better education in these countries. And then while educating them, also I strongly feel that we need to work on helping their, you know, improving the health situation. Health. And there's so many, when I see in India, there's so many women who really look, who are so skinny, and then have so many children, you know, around life. And this is lack of, there's so much lack of health care too. And I think it must be the same with other, you know, Asian countries. You know, I haven't been able to visit. So in this way, I think that is, if we are able to engage in these fields, then, you know, we will be engaging in what is called as engaged Buddhist activities, right? So not, of course, meditating and sitting on comfortable cushion is wonderful. And while sitting on comfortable cushion, we are at ease. We can meditate. We can, you know, generate compassion, love and care. But compassion and love and care, if it is just left on our meditation cushion, it is not going to benefit anyway. So it must be translated into action. And the most effective means of translating them, these, you know, wonderful qualities into action is engaging yourself into some kind of social activity. This I always mention whenever I go with our Buddhist friends, brothers and sisters, because my experience with the Christian brothers and sisters, I came to learn that many of these Christian brothers and sisters are deeply, profoundly, very much engaged in social activities. They run wonderful schools. They have wonderful colleges. They have wonderful, you know, nursing homes, assisted livings. They have wonderful schools for special child, disabled children, like that. When there is some kind of calamity, natural calamity, they are the first ones to come about, jump and, you know, help there. When we had this New Orleans problem, I see so many, you know, Christian brothers and sisters engaged in this social, you know, helping these needy people. Whereas you do not see very much, you know, very many, you know, Buddhists. Of course, Christian brothers and sisters, you know, they outnumber Buddhists, of course. You know, ours is a very, very small number, right? But we must at least see one or two, you know, somewhere there, you know. Helping them. So this has been some kind of situation with our, you know, Buddhist followers. With our, you know, Buddhist followers. Of course, we do have such as, you know, the Sechi, right? We do. Sechi. She is really, you know, a wonderful nun, helping so many, in so many ways, in Taiwan and all over the world. We do have. We must have more. More. We must have more. When I see Christian brothers and sisters, you know, especially, you know, in running the schools in India, Jesuit run schools are the highest standard schools in India. And this, and then we have, you know, the Mother Teresa's Catholic missionary in Calcutta. How they take care of these people. She was named in the beginning, you know, the Hindus kind of challenged her, thinking that she was there to, you know, convert Hindus into Christians. But then there was someone who came to intervene that situation. He was amazed to see that she was carrying a leper person, a leper, in her hand, and you know, giving solace to that person. And then she was named as Saint of the Gutter, because she was picking up these lepers, you know, in the gutters, living in the gutters, and then taking them in her sanctuary and helping and loving them. Many of them were brought there to die peacefully. Many of them were brought there, are being brought even today to die peacefully in a dignified way. If they died in the gutter, it would be really, really sad, you know, because they died in such a difficult, in a, such a hopeless manner. Whereas they are brought there to, if not being treatable, then at least die in a very, very dignified way. At least die as a human. Like that. So in this way, what I really mean is that, you know, from the Buddhist perspective, we need to see all the humans as, you know, having been our mothers and brothers and sisters in our previous lifetimes, and having seen them in this way, of course, to meditate on their kindness is wonderful, but at the same time, in whatever portion, in whatever ability, in whatever manner, even if it is just a small thing you can do, you know, try to translate them into action in benefiting. Even if it is just a single person to, you need to help, try to benefit them. And here comes the real practice of compassion. Here comes the real practice of loving and caring. Because our motivation is so pure, and our action will be so wonderful. And then when we do the dedication, it is the whole composite, the preparation, action, the final ending becomes so pure. And in this way, we will have accumulated enormous, enormous amounts of merits in our spiritual journey. When we think about spiritual journey, we must understand that we are living in this world. We are touching our feet on the world, on the ground. That means we need to have feel for others' needs, others' difficulties, others' sufferings. At the same time, we also need to feel, have a feel, an appreciation of the good things that we see in this world. Wonderful things that we see in this world. Because just by seeing and contemplating on suffering, sometimes you are really very likely to become very pessimistic, hopeless, see. Then you might give up even practicing. So we must, you know, also work on appreciating what is the beauty of the world, the beauty of the humanity, the goodness of the humanity, of others. While appreciating the goodness and seeing the sufferings of the other sentient beings, we also need to look into ourselves. we, like others, too, we do have, you know, goodness, and as well as, you know, badness in our sight. We are not fundamentally bad. We are not fundamentally dark. We are not fundamentally hopeless. If we were fundamentally hopeless, then Buddha would not have spoken any word about the Buddha nature, Buddha potential. Why did Buddha spoke about Buddha potential? It is because each and everyone has Buddha potential within. Fundamentally, we are wonderful. Fundamentally, we have sense of caring for others. Fundamentally, we are great. But what is obscuring us is that we have let these destructive emotions to play a bigger role within us, and not letting our positive qualities to challenge it, and letting the positive qualities just, you know, remain as it is. So in our spiritual journey, we need to wake up, say, I have enough of these destructive emotions. I have enough of it. Just, we must say to ourselves, I have enough of it. Now, that's it. Now I'm not letting you play the role, you know, in anymore in my life. I want my positive qualities to play the role again, which I had left, you know, in a kind of a indifferently. Now I'm not let. I'll arouse the positive qualities. Let these role. Let them play the role. And what the positive qualities? Basic sense of caring for others. Appreciation for what you do yourself. Having genuine respect for others, at the same time having trust for oneself. When we respect for others, why? Because we trust in their qualities, wonderful qualities. So we need to also have respect for ourselves while trusting ourselves. What we get to see is that people start to mistrust oneself. People tend to feel to have some kind of low esteemed attitude, forgetting about their potential. And if we have this kind of low sense of attitude, seeing that I'm just nothing like that, then everything becomes nothing. Even a simple task which can be achievable will not be achieved by us, because we have already labeled ourselves as nothing, a hopeless person. On the other hand, if we are able to arouse in us, inspire us, so I can achieve something, I have the Buddha potential, then even the most difficult task, which seem to be unachievable, can be achieved with our, you know, determination and continuous effort. We must always keep in mind that when we read the Buddha's teachings, when we listen to the teachers speaking, when we are with the Dharma friends, we should always be mindful of the fact that they are there to help me, to guide me. Not something they are there to take me to the pure land. They are there just to guide you. They cannot take us, like flying in an aeroplane, taking you to the pure land. After all, when we think about pure land, I always think it is not somewhere in the universe. Rather, it is somewhere within you. You need to reveal it yourself. It has to be revealed in you. We have to reveal the pure land in us. That is why Buddha Shakyamuni, just before passing away, what he mentioned was, work on making yourself an island. Work on making yourself a lamp. So, island, pure land, must be within ourselves, must be revealed from within. The lamp must be lit from within. And if we are able to do so, then really we have opened the doorway for reaching to many different realizations, to the state of enlightenment. When we speak about journeying to the state of enlightenment, it is not a journey that we do something like when we do journeying for a hiking. Not going somewhere else. It is not physical. It is a spiritual journey that we must cultivate from within, prepare from within, arise from within, and attain from within. Everything is from within. We get to see some Westerners in Dharamsala asking, where is the pure land? I think many of them have come seeing that Dharamsala is a kind of pure land, thinking that mistakenly. And then when Dharamsala is not pure land, they wanted to find pure land somewhere else. So we have such a kind of mistaken attitude, mistaken thoughts. So in this way, really what we need to work on is, as His Holiness always mentions, that when we tread on a spiritual journey, we must think that we are on a kind of a work on transforming ourselves. And transformation, His Holiness always mentions, that does not happen in one day. During an interview with the Emory students this year, I was fortunate to be with them, and at the audience one of the students asked, what is the how to deal with the challenges in the West in practicing the Dharma. His holiness pondered for some time. He said that you need to continue the practice. He said that he has been practicing the Dharma from childhood, and now he is over 70 years and he is still practicing. Never give up. Never give up. Like that. So we must understand that spiritual journey is something that needs to be practiced continuously without giving up. If you do it today and neglect it for a few days, then it's not going to make much impact. Even if it is like a small period of time in a day, I'm sure you all are busy and sometimes you hardly get time to sit even because of this busy life. But while in the busy state, it is very helpful to think about the Dharma even for 5 minutes. Then it is like recharging your battery. If the battery is recharged continuously, then you will have the benefit of the battery life. You leave the battery uncharged, then again to recharge it takes time, it takes longer time, like that. So give some moment of your time in spiritual practice, whether it is at a daytime, at noon, or in the evening, but never give up. Never give up. Like if you have given up for 1 week, then we have a tendency of giving up, having a break with the Dharma for another 2 weeks, maybe then 3 weeks. Then Dharma is gone somewhere, You are here and Dharma is somewhere, Then to retrieve it again, back it is very difficult. It's very difficult. So in this way, I do not want to take much of your time. So, when we speak about, when we think about compassion and global peace, I think first, each of us should work on, bringing some kind of compassion, and then sharing that compassion to anyone, everywhere, wherever you are. And in this way, we can make some impact on the world, in bringing more peace and tranquility, and long-lasting happiness, not only for oneself, but for a greater number of humanity in this world. So I start.